Dr. Smith, maybe a couple of seconds and I will.
Hello, I'm Selwyn Manning and you are watching A View From Afar, and today we are joined by political scientist and former Pentagon analyst Paul Buchanan, and this week we will discuss how around the world in international relations we see examples of strategic hedging, miscalculation, escalation, reputation and face saving. Two of the most current examples of this happening are in the Middle East, after the killing of Iran's leading nuclear scientist, and in Australia, as the People's Republic of China towers above the US-leaning Indo-Pacific regional power Australia, claiming that it propagates anti-China sentiment around the world. So what states are behind the Iran assassination? Who benefits from this killing? And how should Iran respond? And why is China destabilizing Australia's economic interests and its security interests? And what is China's endgame? Will this dangerous posturing ease in late January when the United States President-elect Joe Biden takes up office in the White House? These are all questions that Paul and I will discuss. But first, here is an invitation to those of you who are joining us live. If you are joining via YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter, feel free to make comments, and if you do, we'll be able to include those comments in our program. So let's cross to Paul, who is waiting online to unpick the complexities of this issue. Good afternoon, Paul.
Good afternoon, Selwyn, from the steamy Waitakere Ranges. I feel like I'm living in Singapore again.
You've got humidity kind of wrapping around you in that warm embrace by the sound of it. We've got rain clouds here in Auckland City. There's certainly we're in for a little bit of a steamy beginning to the December months here as summer kind of ticks toward us, doesn't it?
I'm living in a cloud, but it's good for the water tanks. You know, we collect water off the roof out here in these ranges, and so it's a little sticky, but it's overall good for the plants and good for the tank.
That's certainly the case. Now let's get into the issues, Paul. So this Iran assassination, we've seen shadows of this before with respect to Iran's nuclear ambitions, and particularly the destruction of its nuclear reactors in the past. And we've seen scientists taken out, obviously targets. What do you make of it all, Paul?
Well, the killing of Fakhrizadeh, as the head of the Iranian nuclear scientist program is known, clearly is designed to disrupt any possibility of rapprochement between the United States and Iran with regards to the now canceled P5+1 nuclear weapons control agreement that was signed years ago and then abandoned by the United States in 2018. And so that's the clear intent. It's also a provocation on several sides, because we have to remember that the Iranian regime is not monolithic. You know, it's not homogeneous. There are, I'll take a crude division, moderates and militants. Militants mostly being in the Revolutionary Guard, but also including people in the nuclear program. And so the idea here is a variation of the sucker ploy. You try to sucker these militant elements, hardliners, hawks, in the United States as well as Iran, into engaging in some sort of confrontation that kills off those talks for the foreseeable future, presents Biden with an impossible choice to go ahead reopening those talks in the face of an Iranian retaliation against Israel, who's the prime suspect, and or the Gulf Council states and or the United States itself in the region, or let it slide. Now, the interesting thing is that, to my mind, this is clearly the work of Israel. You mentioned it. There's a pattern here of them assassinating nuclear scientists, both in Iran as well as outside of Iran, as well as targeting their facilities directly. But who has the most to gain from this sort of disruptive game? And it's Benjamin Netanyahu. He's got some serious political troubles at home. He has been consistent in warning that the Iranian nuclear program is more advanced than many people believe. And he's now getting down to the final days of the Trump administration, which gives him political cover to undertake these sort of things. The United States would have been told or warned about the strike in the hours before it. I doubt it had direct involvement in the assassination for a variety of reasons. Again, this wasn't done by Mossad. It was more than likely done by a proxy. The most likely proxy is a leftist Iranian dissident group that goes by the acronym MEK. And then they've carried out these sort of attacks before. So, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu has the most to gain by the suspension of those talks and the process of gaining some control, international control, over the Iranian nuclear weapons development program, which is clearly in place, will have to be abandoned yet again. There's an interesting sidebar to this. The Iranians might have anticipated some sort of attack along these lines. They didn't know precisely who would be targeted or what, but Supreme Leader Khamenei, as well as Joe Biden, have already said in the wake of the assassination that they will continue to reopen the dialogue between the two countries. And that augurs well. They're not going to rise to the bait. See, right now the ball is in the Iranians' court. What do? They've been attacked twice by their greatest enemies within the space of a year, less than a year. They had their Revolutionary Guard commander killed in Baghdad last January by the United States. And now they have this leading nuclear scientist killed by the Israelis or their proxies. What do they do? Well, in January, they retaliated with missile strikes on U.S. bases in Iraq and left it at that. Here, they may just lay dormant or quiet in order to get to those talks, give Biden, if you will, some breathing room so that they can resume the talks. And then if they are going to strike back, which I think they will have to because of their own domestic reasons, then they'll do so at a time and place that they're choosing, unencumbered by the urgent need to resume these talks in order to lift the sanctions regime that has been imposed by the U.S. against them.
Yeah. Now, of course, what we've seen in recent days is not a military retaliation by Iran. If there were attempts to actually incite that type of response, it hasn't worked so far. But what we have seen is Iran saying in its parliament, and then the rule came through from there, saying that it will not allow inspections of its nuclear program to continue at this time. That's the IAEA. Inspections, of course. So that's what we've been seeing up on screen. So you see that this potential move, this move by Iran, is potentially basically giving them breathing space. It's a gesture to Biden's incoming administration that if they can, they will respond only after he actually takes the White House. Is that a fair connection of logic to what you're saying there?
Yeah. I think this is yet another bargaining chip that the Iranians will use. But what they want is sanctions relief. Yeah. And in order to get that, the United States has to reverse the Trump maximum sanctions policy, which also punishes third parties that do trade with Iran. and resume or have the United States reincorporated into the P5+1 talks. And Biden shows a disposition to get back there. Remember, he was the vice president of the administration that participated in P5+1 that led to the nuclear agreement in the first place. So long as the Iranians don't retaliate militarily and soon, once we get to inauguration day, I think one of the first orders of business when it comes to Biden's foreign policy team is to resume talks with the Iranians. And in fact, I would say that as part of the transition, not that I know anything from the inside, but I would imagine that the Biden team, through intermediaries, is quietly reassuring the Iranians that as long as they remain calm and don't do anything crazy that forces Biden's hand on the military front, i.e. such as attacking the Gulf states or Israel, then there'll be plenty to talk about after January 20th.
Mm. So you're seeing this also with connections relating to a pattern around the world with respect to international relations, the destabilization, the then miscalculation of how far particular powers go to destabilize what they perceive as their opponents. And of course, there's this issue with China basically versus the Australians. And it looks like the relationship, which is key to the region, isn't it, is very fast, has broken down. It's not fast breaking down, it is broken down. You've got your, and from Canberra, the capital of Australia, Australian Capital Territory, you've got the diplomats taking the hard line, and also the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, taking a hard line and responding, demanding an apology from China over what Canberra perceives as, well, an insult relating to a doctored JPEG image of an Australian soldier with a knife to the throat of an Afghani child. You've got the trade wing from Canberra basically saying, we want business as usual, please pick up our phone. China diplomats refusing to answer a simple thing like a phone call from Australia. How do you place this into the context, Paul? How far has China gone with this? What's its purpose in doing it, and what's its end game?
Well, the broader picture is that we have entered into a new era of coercive or dissuasive diplomacy. It's not about persuasion anymore. It's not soft power. It's coercive power, and in this case, diplomatically, that was coercive power that we saw used in Iran 10 days ago or so. And that, of course, speaks to something that you and I have talked about from time to time, which is the erosion of international norms, the lack of respect now for international convention and mores and that sort of thing. But that's water under the bridge. We've reached a new low, and that low is the relationship between Australia and China, which literally is at the taunting stage. I mean, this is play yard sort of stuff. And so the question that I have, and I'm sure you share it, is what's the purpose of this? You know, I mean, there's an old saying that diplomacy is hypocrisy masquerading as virtue. And sure, there is hypocrisy on the part of the Australians pushing human rights in China when, as it turns out, their record on human rights at home, I mean, won't even get into the treatment of Aboriginals and whatnot, but that their record in certain military theaters, most recently Afghanistan, is less than sterling. And the Chinese have picked up on that. And quite frankly, they've been trolling the Australians with the Photoshop picture, with cartoons in the government-controlled press. And, you know, my thought is, okay, this is, you know, beyond trolling. What's the strategic objective here? Then it gets interesting because, as you just pointed out, the Chinese know that the Australians are an export-led economy and that one of their biggest partners, I think number two behind the United States, is the People's Republic.
I think the People's Republic has just taken over as the most significant, with 40% of its one-way trade. 40% of Australia's one-way trade, it represents 40% of that.
What I found in it, thanks for that clarification, because yeah, now you see that the amount of leverage that the Chinese can have by imposing exorbitant tariffs. I initially thought, well, they're putting tariffs on non-essential items like wine and that sort of thing. I mean, no economy is going to tank because they can't export wine. But on the other hand, I just read that they're also imposing tariffs on coal. I mean, heavy industrial material, primary materials. And so they're, you know, this is a little beyond cutting their nose to spite their face. The Chinese obviously think that they have alternative sources of coal energy, more than likely from Africa.
Yes, that's the point. Coming out of Canberra, there are concerns from the trade wing, which are actually underlying this, and they're saying that China is lining up alternatives to iron ore imports. So it renders that more competitive in that negotiation that Australia has with China. There are also arguments that bauxite, you know, the core component of aluminium, that China has alternatives lined up in that area. Obviously not as handy as what is exported from the Chinese continent, but it's still in existence there. It seems like China, where it's kicking back on the trade front, was like, we saw it first a number of months ago with respect to imports of barley from Australia, hitting at a time where it's going to impact seasonally on its primary producers. And clearly, politically, that starts to hurt the Nationals, part of the Liberal National Coalition in Australia. And then we see the wine industry. It's almost like a flag, isn't it? The Great Barossa Valley, et cetera, and all the other regions of Australia that are famous as well. And the Chinese whacking on tariffs, despite free trade agreements in other areas, they've found a way of being able to whack tariffs, punish Australia for perceived misdemeanors. So that whole thing is rocking Australia from within, particularly on the trade economic side.
But you see, so there, as it turns out, there's an eminent rationality to what they're doing. This is beyond trolling. You know, that's just, you know, rubbing the Australian noses in it because they can't do much about it. Think about it this way. The same sort of tactic was applied against red states in the United States when Trump imposed tariffs across the board on Chinese products. The Chinese selectively retaliated against the states where there were MAGA majorities, mostly rural agricultural states, as it turns out. And this is a variation of the theme in Australia, because they are, in fact, hurting the main support base for the Liberal coalition. And so there's some intelligence applied here to demonstrate to the Australians that China is much more powerful than they are, has more leverage on them than the Australians have on the Chinese because of that economic dependency. And therefore, the Australians should be a lot more judicious when engaging China, particularly on issues, say, for example, influence operations in Australia, human rights in general. And I think what the precipitant was, or at least the proximate cause, was the very strong Australian calls for an independent international investigation into the origins of the coronavirus in China.
Yeah. And, so this is the beginning of it. This is the beginning. Yeah. And if you look at the 14-point list of grievances, if you like, that China has seeded into the Australian media by way of the Sydney Morning Herald, the Australian and The Age, etc., It details that pretty much as the primary beginning of it. So then it lists things where it believes that Australia hasn't controlled its media with this anti-China voice that it's detecting coming from the mainstream Australian media. These areas Australia has tried to communicate back that it's not within its control within a liberal democracy, where the fourth estate is able to express as it will within certain guidelines and parameters. But there's a list of these types of things. But the other common thread is that it is connecting Australia's external rhetoric, its security relationship that it has developed with Japan most recently as being at the behest of the United States Trump administration. There's, without going into the points point by point, the common theme is that there is a connection between Australia and the United States, and it sees the United States obviously as a trade enemy, and now it is perceiving Australia in the same light. We've also seen this new phenomenon, if you like, in diplomatic terms, of course, with the Five Eyes countries, Paul. So that, once again, that's the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, a security relationship which is now being used, led by the United States, as a diplomatic wing, if you like, which, with joint statements opposing China's approach to Hong Kong, Taiwan, and other areas, particularly of provinces inside China. And China's responses in this 14-point grievance is that a security alliance grouping is now diplomatically interfering in its own domestic affairs. Bang. So within that, you can see there's subjectivism. There is elements of, well, and sometimes you would refer to it as a silly response on China's part. And in other areas, there is room for negotiation and clarity. And there's certainly other areas with respect to Australia where they will not move off patch. For example, making their decisions independently as a state, it's their prerogative relating to Huawei and the 5G products being included in Australia's networks, and they're just not going there for security reasons. That's one of the grievances that China has. So within that, do you think that they've got to a stage where these two powers, a regional power relating to with respect to Australia, and a global power asserting its might with respect to the People's Republic of China, that a third party actually requires to be in the mix, wherever that may come from, to try and get steps toward rapprochement?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there obviously is some cognitive dissonance on the part of the Chinese when it comes to understanding liberal democracies. Now, I do think that they believe that their influence within the Australian domestic scene is such that they can actually extract some concessions by the Australians when it comes to press freedom, or at least criticism of China in the mass media. The larger geostrategic aspect is very interesting, though. Because if you put yourself in the Chinese shoes, because their continued growth as a great power is going to force them to rub shoulders in the wrong way with the United States and its allies. And so it looks to the east, and it's got its main rival, the United States, now totally focused on a state-to-state level of countering China. And then it has this vulnerability to the south. The United States' greatest ally in the southern hemisphere is Australia, and Australia is becoming a little bit more than a middle-sized military power, and works hand in glove with the United States wherever the United States goes. So I think the Chinese have decided to do a little divide and conquer while the time is still opportune, and work the Australians over in order to see if, and nothing else, they can get them to pause or think twice before they just blindly stumble along with the United States, regardless of who's in power with the United States, because the confrontation with China is going to continue under Biden. It may even deepen. It just won't be as vulgar and crass as it was under the Trump administration. Now, I got to give you credit, because you've identified something, and we've, in some private conversations, have gone through this, but credit to you. To bring up the point that what is essentially a signals intelligence sharing alliance, the Five Eyes, has come out and issued a joint critique of China with regards to the end of democracy in Hong Kong. And if I was one of the bosses of the Five Eyes partners, the intelligence agencies involved, I say, let's not do this. Yeah. Let's not touch this as a network. We could cloak it in the Commonwealth. We could cloak it in a statement by liberal democracies that include countries other than the Five Eyes countries. But the Chinese would be absolutely right to say, look, you're turning your intelligence network into a diplomatic battering ram, and we're going to push back. And that's an interesting, I mean, that's a very interesting insight. I don't know why the Five Eyes did that, perhaps because the Trump administration, again, very vulgar in its approach, coarse in its approach, heavied its partners to go along with this.
Because the British are off pitch. They've got their own problems back home, both within their own Tory leading party, the Conservatives, and also with the COVID epidemic there, you know, it's suffering, and also the discussions with the EU relating to Brexit. So it is just not engaging on these issues relating to Hong Kong. It is not engaging on these. It's not taking a leading role with respect to those Westminster-style countries like Canada and New Zealand on the Five Eyes kind of positioning. This has to be coming from Washington.
Yeah, and in the waning days of the Trump administration is not the time to start, you know, engaging in this sort of initiative. Again, you know, it you know, as you said it in, over the past few days, I'm like, you know, he's absolutely right. This is an intelligence network. It should stay in the shadows. There's many ways to cloak criticism over what's going on in Hong Kong.
Yeah, and what I'm sorry, Paul, but my main point on that too is that because New Zealand is a member of the Five Eyes network, that's an intelligence network. When we blur the lines, it corrupts the identity of this small country for its ability to speak to other powers on the basis of moderation, of mediation, and solutions. It takes that independence voice out, of which it has been used in the past. And I'll just cite back in the early 2000s relating to the problems on the Korean Peninsula. New Zealand took a back seat, back door kind of approach under Helen Clark up there in Seoul, where it connected the People's Republic of China, the United States' interest, South Korea, North Korea, to get around the table, and then Japan came in later with what was known as the Five Nations talks. New Zealand had a significant role with Clark in brokering the beginnings of that actually happening. And this is what I'm talking about here. If we see New Zealand purely and simply as under the umbrella of the Five Eyes network, and if China perceives it as so, then New Zealand's ability to actually potentially get into a table situation where it starts to mediate on points that are disrupting this region and New Zealand's own interests, it renders it obsolete. I suggest that it ought not to go down the Five Eyes diplomatic route. And New Zealand should exceed its independence and keep that opportunity, for what it's worth, open.
No, the point is well made. I mean, what's done is done. But I think that we have to think of it this way. Again, I like to put myself in the other guy's shoes. There, you know, the hard fact of the matter is that the Chinese know that New Zealand eavesdrops on Chinese communications and signals. The reason for that is that China is the priority target state-wise of Five Eyes espionage. And New Zealand has a track record of spying on allies as well as adversaries. Think, for example, of the silliness involved in spying on behalf of Tim Grosser, his candidacy to be head of the WTO.
Silliness, I mean, underscored, Paul.
Yeah.
I mean, what on earth?
So the Chinese know all of this.
Yeah.
And so now we come out with this statement, and you just said it. I mean, we've ruined any possibility of playing the role of honest broker. And I'll just say, you know, I'll just say a theoretical thing, which is that just because you have an independent foreign policy doesn't mean that in every instance you can be an honest broker, at least when your allies are involved, and especially when your security allies are involved. The Chinese know all of this. So here's what I would say, though, and this gets back to the 14 points that they were upset about with Australia. The strategy here, be it by New Zealand or even the Australian government, although I think things are too far gone, you disaggregate those 14 points.
Yep.
You find out which points are negotiable without a lot of rhetoric and heat. And that's where a small country like China could say, look, this is not a security matter. You know, we're not spying on you in order to try to play the role of mediator. and separate out each point by point into what is feasible and doable in the short term, which in turn can then grow the levels of trust, or at least lessen the levels of enmity between the Australians and the Chinese. I just think that with that declaration, as much as I liked it, I mean, I liked it, right? It upheld democratic values and all that. I think that it was a tactical mistake on the part of the Five Eyes. And for the life of me, I wonder why New Zealand signed on, given that
there's been
we're the small guy.
The difference is we've had a change in foreign minister. And it may be that the wily experience and sage positioning of Winston Peters earlier on, when New Zealand did not join the Five Eyes combined statement relating to Hong Kong earlier in this year, it did once he was off patch. And, you know, of course, just for those that are overseas, we're talking about Foreign Minister, Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, whose party and himself lost their ability to get back into the parliament in the October elections here in New Zealand. Paul, we've got a question here I brought up briefly on site just before. They'll bring it up again. It's from Di Trower here. Very good point, she said, very good point about the Five Eyes statement. She says, and why it should not have been done that way. I wonder how New Zealand is going to fare now by aligning itself to Australia's predicament and supporting them, although it probably needed to be done. Will our eyes get poked out too? What do you think?
Well, I think that that's a little bit more than a veiled threat, and Di is correct in wondering, you know, where is this going to lead? I will say, by the way, Selwyn, you're being a very naughty boy criticizing the new foreign minister, given that all that she represents to certain constituencies. Your only salvation here is that the former prime minister is Maori, and so they're not going to attack you on those grounds, but otherwise...
No, I was more talking about the window of opportunity before she really gets her feet under the desk.
Yeah.
So hey, there you go. There's my way out. So
you're being straight up about it, and I appreciate it, but I'm like, oh, man, he's going to catch some flack for that one. But you're right. Hey, and I'll join you. You're absolutely right. She was a novice stepping in and probably didn't get the advice that Winston Peters didn't need. You know, he would have said, no, this is a minefield. I'm not touching this one. But hey, you live and learn. Now, you know, the Chinese, you know, basically said you could get your eyes poked out if you meddle in our internal affairs. And see, there it gets in again to this cultural dissonance and whatnot, because you know, they really view Hong Kong as part of the motherland. We look at it as a former British colony with, you know, the autonomous zone. They say to themselves, we got to do what we got to do. We'll negotiate with the British and promise them a lot of things about devolution and the special, you know, status of Hong Kong, but it's ours. It's part of China. And so once the opportunity presented itself to basically de facto incorporate Hong Kong into the Chinese political system, they went ahead and did so because the strategic moment, the global balance of power, favors them, at least in their own region, rather than the Western powers and certainly the ex-colonial power, Great Britain. So New Zealand was a little bit foolhardy to step into that fracas. I mean, the United States, Britain itself, Canada have some degree of insulation from direct Chinese retaliation, you know, the pain that they'll feel if China embargoes some trade or does things of that sort will be less than what could happen to New Zealand, given that not only is China our greatest trading partner, but we're increasingly dependent on it. You know, they said way back when that we would put a lot of eggs in different baskets. And what's happened, as almost as inevitable in this stage of capitalist globalization, is that we now have trade concentration in the bilateral with China. Sure, we still trade with a lot of other places, but increasingly the Chinese have gathered up our balance of trade in their favor, and then as a percentage of GDP, and our politicians, our trade negotiators simply didn't realize what was coming. And so we're, as a result of that, our dependence is greater, And if our dependence is greater, then our vulnerability is greater to a range of retaliatory measures that fall far short of military action.
Yeah, I think New Zealand does have to actually respond. If we're talking about New Zealand in this respect, for this reason, remember that the comment came out from China this week as well toward New Zealand that we bleat like Australian sheep. And so it's the same kind of thing. New Zealand government won't respond in the same way of Australia. Yeah. You know, they'll take the moral high ground and think, yeah, okay, you can say these kind of things. It means nothing to us. We know who we are. So that's fine. But if you were looking at it going forward from here, this is not going away with respect to Australia and China. Australia is a proud nation of independence in its own right. China is a global power, and it knows it is, and it expects, because of the cultural observances within the Chinese culture of never losing face, particularly when you're in a point of power, and the expectation is of that the weak will lose face. The expectation could be argued that it expects Australia to back down and comply. Out of that mix, I think there is a history, for example, with respect to the People's Republic of China and New Zealand, where over many years it trusted New Zealand to assist it at the WTO inclusion with its first free trade agreement. There is a history where New Zealand can reconnect on common ground. Perhaps my argument is, Paul, that that's a part of the way forward. I'm really interested to hear yours.
Well, it's interesting, and again, this is something that you and I have talked about privately. The cultural dimension of foreign policy as a variation of what is known as the second image. The second image is the domestic sources of foreign policy. We tend to think of, you know, realism and state-to-state interactions, but each state is informed by a variety of factors, one of which is culture. Now, normally, my academic training as a realist would say, well, let's not pay much mind to culture. You know, the reality of warfare and whatnot imposes, if you will, a supra-rationality on everybody. You know, again, think of the nuclear weapons deterrence. You know, it's a rationality that has nothing to do with culture and all to do with self-preservation.
Or morality.
But in this instance, I think that what's interesting is this the idea of face. It's not just about face saving on the part of the Chinese. They're not going to be pushed around by a regional power now that they are a global great power. But I was thinking, okay, so what you want to do is humiliate the Australians for what purpose? I mean, what, you know, again, the trolling. And then I thought, you know, in a way, this is a warning to Australia and others that if you don't want to lose real face, then you need to bend to our will. Real face losing would be diplomatic losses, economic losses that are devastating on the domestic economy. I mean, being trolled by a Photoshop or a cartoon, you know, that's not a real loss of face, okay? That's an insult. That's a yeah. nose tweak. Yeah. But real loss of face is they put you in there in your place economically, diplomatically, and militarily. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it?
The United States isn't going to open up its agriculture markets to Australia.
No.
It's not going to come and pay the bill, if you like.
No, in fact, right now, I mean, we'll see with Biden because he's already, unfortunately, you know, again, harking to other talks we've had, he's going back to full liberal internationalist. Yep. The trouble is the world's changed. I mean, you know this. So I'm preaching to the converted. let's say for the sake of argument, the Chinese sink a Australian frigate that is running that picket line in the South China Sea. What are the Australians going to do about it? Nothing. What is the United States going to do about it? Nuke China? Find a place to hit? Maybe they'll hit the islands, but that risks escalation way out of proportion to the loss of one vessel. I mean, that's why the Chinese have the advantages here. They know it. And I think that all of this posturing and the back and forth is actually their way of not so subtly warning the Australians to not continue down a path that could lead to a real loss of face. And I think it was interesting, a person wiser than me, a Chinese Australian in Canberra, mentioned in a Twitter discussion that it was very silly of the Australians to rise to the bait of the photoshopped image, that they should have done what New Zealand did with regards to the dumb comment about sheep and either ignore it entirely or just say, well, it's a fake, so it doesn't matter, or a variation of something I learned when I worked for the Clinton administration, which was when you get critiqued by things that could draw you into much bigger things, just ignore them or dismiss them as silly. Just say, oh, that was very silly, and then move on. Because it's a way of drawing you. I was talking about the sucker ploy earlier. This Photoshop could be seen as a variation of that. They're trying to sucker the Australians into a bigger stoush that they cannot win. So, you know, I think the cultural dimension is interesting because it's embedded and yet informs the larger strategic rationality.
And the behaviors.
The Chinese are nothing if not rational. And I think, yeah, I saw the cultural element. I sort of wondered, you know, this is infantile, you know, playground bully type tactics. But the more I think about it, again, thanks to some of the stuff you've said, you know, I'm like, you know, they're putting this in their own way, their Han way, as, you know, a heads up to the Australians that before they get to playing hardball, there's all this fluff. And you can sort it out amid all the fluff, or you can get, to mix metaphors, down to brass tacks. And in that sort of contest, Australia will not win, in part because the United States will not come to its rescue in the measure that it says it will.
Yeah, let that sober line there be the conclusion today. Thanks, Paul. Thanks you for your insights, your wisdom, and your contributions once again in A View from Afar. And thank you to those that joined us live and also those that see this on demand or also via audio podcast on the Apple network and soon to be on others as well. So do look it up, A View from Afar, Evening Report, Paul Buchanan, Selwyn Manning, all of those kind of things in the search streams. You'll be able to actually subscribe to the podcast there, or go to Evening Report and you'll see a button to subscribe to the podcast there. Thank you. Look forward to your company again next week. Goodbye.